Good morning.
Good morning.
Nice to see you all this morning. So my name is Kikan Mike Howard. I'm a priest in training here. I was ordained last February during a big blizzard. Very exciting. And the title of this talk is Making Peace with Hippie Zen. The original title was Living with Hippie Zen, but I decided that that might come across as a bit negative. Anyway, you'll see what I'm talking about later on. Now we're making peace with Hippie Zen. So, what I would like to do is read one of my favorite sections from this book. This is The Light That Shines Through Infinity, Zen and the Energy of Life, by Dainin Katagiri Roshi, edited by, Andrea Martin. And this is a collection of Katagiri Roshi's talks. Katagiri Roshi is no longer with us. He passed away in the 1990s, 94, if I remember correctly.
90?
Oh, wow. That early. But actually, the recordings of most of his talks are online. They're put online on this podcast called Katagiri Roshi Podcasts. You can look this up. It's amazing stuff, and there are now 4 books of his collected and edited talks. This is one that just came out recently, so the community is pretty excited about it. And it's, I would say, a wonderful book. When I volunteer up at the Rush City Correctional Facility once a month, they have a prison sangha up there. What I do is I read like a little bit from this book. And so we've been doing that for a total of about 8 hours now. We've spent 8 hours on this book up there. It's kind of like a small group of inmates in the high security prison chapel. We've spent about 8 hours and we just made it to the end of chapter 1. This book is great because you can read a bit of it, and it's so, it's such concentrated Dharma that it's pretty easy, relatively easy to lead a discussion jumping off from this point. So that's what I'd like to do today, actually. Well, since this is a more formal group, what I'm going to do is read the section that is at the end of chapter 1. It's not terribly long. I think it would be better to just read the whole thing so you kind of know what we're dealing with. And then I'll go back and kind of go through it and offer my thoughts. And we'll leave some time, whatever happens at the end, for comments and questions. Does that sound all right? I'm pretty sure I'll say in advance that I'm not going to be able to get to everything that I would like to say about even this one small section of the book, because it's a really particularly juicy section and almost a little provocative in a way that you may see, which is why it's my favorite section. There's been some polite disagreements in the community. It's also been discussed on Wednesday evenings here. We have a tea and conversation, and we've looked at this chapter 1 a little bit occasionally, but it's actually challenging because we only have like a half hour on Wednesday evenings, which actually doesn't seem to be like long enough to really get into it. But we've done a little bit anyway. And you may also be familiar with this book because So San's done a talk on it, and Gentle Dragon has done a talk on it, and everyone talks on it everywhere pretty much. So if it looks familiar, it's not your imagination. So the section is Trusting in Self. This is edited Katagiri Roshi speaking. Zen Buddhism is not a philosophy like rationalism or empiricism. Zen is actual life. But when you study Zen, sometimes it may seem that Zen denies the value of intellectual understanding and depends only on direct experience. For example, I'm always telling people how they can learn the meaning of Zazen meditation, but they won't actually know what Zazen is until they experience it. So after I talk, finally I have to say, please sit down and practice Zazen. Or I can explain what water is, but to understand water, you have to drink it. So I say, please drink a cup of water. But then people immediately think Zen means don't think, just sit, just drink. That is not Zen. If you live like this, your life is hippie style. Can everybody see this okay? Should we turn the lights down a little bit?
No, that's good.
Oh my goodness, I don't have the microphone on. Okay, how's that? Better? I'm used to performing in venues where there's no amplification, sorry. In San Francisco in the 1960s, there were many young people called hippies. One day I came across a hippie-style Zen student on a train and asked him where he was heading for. He said, I don't know, I just rely on my feet. Well, that way of life seems to be freedom, but I don't think it is freedom. It is confusion. If you live in that way, maybe it's because you think it's not necessary to make any effort to deepen your life or build up your life for your future or for the sake of future generations. Maybe you say, I don't have to care about the future. All I have to do is just be present right here, right now. But actually, you cannot live like that. You cannot control your life according to ideas of caring or not caring. Life is completely beyond that. During the Second World War, I was a high school boy sent to the southern part of Japan to be an airplane mechanic in the army. The situation there was terrible and always changing very rapidly. If you think about it even a little bit, you realize there is a chance you will have to die. So I didn't think about the past or the future. Every day, I just thought, I don't care. In other words, I didn't know where I was heading. Then one day I heard an airplane drop a big bomb. Immediately I jumped into a hole and chanted the name of Amitabha Buddha, asking for help. In that very moment, I did not actually live according to I don't care. When the bomb came, I tried to save my life. So what is my life? My life is my life, but my life is also something more. It is something broad, something vast and alive beyond my narrow, egoistic ideas. This is the real reality of my existence. That's really wonderful. In San Francisco, when I asked the student I met on the train where he was heading, he said, I don't know, I just rely on my feet. This is not a good answer. I often say, when the morning comes, just get up. But that just get up doesn't mean you get up ignoring your future, your hope, your destination. If you don't have a destination, you cannot just get up. Of course, you can get up in the ordinary way, but if you want to go deep into your life and learn who you really are, you should have a destination. You should know where you are heading. If so, where are you heading? Know where you are heading, but don't attach to your destination. If you are riding on a train, just be intimate with the train, with yourself, the other passengers, and all the circumstances around you. Then the big scale of self appears. Big self is very quiet. But if I ask you where you are heading, you can say, I am going to the Zendo. That's enough. Why do you get up in the morning? I want to do Zazen. Saying I want to do Zazen is not an idea, it is vivid activity. You accept the feeling of sleepiness, you accept your emotions that are creating lots of complaints, and then you just get up. That's enough. This is Zen practice. It's a very simple practice. Whoever you are, wherever you are, whatever you do, your life is already present in real reality. That is your real self, your true self. To realize this truth, all you have to do is take care of your small, noisy self with your big, quiet self. It's not usually the laugh line, but okay. Then, at that time, your life is very calm, and you can get up in the morning with stability and imperturbability. Your real self is always with you. You cannot escape it. Finally, this real self is the only thing that you can trust in. If you want to learn what human life really is and know the truth of Buddha's teachings, there is no other way than starting to learn what that self is. This is one thing that you can depend on, or this one thing that you can depend on is something you have to research. You have to understand what it is. So instead of seeing your life only through your narrow, egoistic telescope, constantly keep your eyes open to seeing with a broader perspective, even if you don't understand it exactly. To fully understand human life, you have to go deep into you and see human life more deeply. The depth of your life is your destination, but don't attach to it. Just constantly try to deepen your life. This is spiritual life. Through spiritual practice, you can deepen your life. You can really know what is at the bottom of human life. That is the teaching of Shakyamuni Buddha and the emphasis of Zen Buddhism. So let's learn who we are. That's the end of chapter one. So I'll offer some thoughts on this. As I see it, do we have time left for me to answer some, to add some thoughts on it? So as I see it, this section is more or less about the interplay of structure and formlessness, or discipline and relaxation in Zen practice. Another way of putting it is the dance of effort and letting go. This section actually has some context that is helpful to know. It's actually continuing on from a previous section in which Katagiri Roshi talked about how we strive for solutions to our problems in life, which are constantly arising, using rational thought through means like psychology, religion, philosophy, even physics, chemistry, better living through chemistry. That works to some extent, but ultimately is unsatisfying because it denies our direct experience. To quote from the earlier passage, Shakyamuni Buddha taught us how to approach this question. Instead of paying attention only to ideas, we also have to pay attention to the real state of our existence. We have to pay attention to the whole reality of human life. That is spiritual practice. So now, in the previous section, having established that Zen is about direct experience, as Roshi says, people make the somewhat understandable mistake of thinking that Zen discounts rational thought and planning. Seems reasonable, right? No, apparently not. And also, I think this section could be interpreted as correcting a frequent misunderstanding of Zen and Buddhism in general, which is where I think it gets interesting. This misunderstanding is particularly common in America, where we coined the phrase Zenning out, which as I think means basically the same thing as zoning out. Basically, I think that means passing the time in a pleasant way by dabbling with your own mental state and not paying too much attention to what's going on either internally or externally. So I'm going to go out on a limb and say that that is not what Zen is actually about. But this misunderstanding, I would say, isn't unique to America, so we can feel better. It isn't a new misunderstanding, it's actually a very old misunderstanding. For example, Dogen, 13th century Zen master, who was the priest who brought Zen from China to Japan, just as Katagiri Roshi in our lineage was the priest who brought Zen from Japan to America, so they have a lot in common. Dogen was dissatisfied, concerned, I'm not sure what the word is, with Zen in Japan. Zen already was present in Japan when Dogen was practicing there. There was the Tendai school, but he felt like he wasn't getting the answers that he was looking for. Specifically, in the Tendai school, they had this idea about Buddha nature, that we're all perfect as we are, which, okay, we actually are, but then Dogen's question is, well, why should I be doing this practice then? This doesn't seem to actually make any sense. And in the school in Japan at the time, they actually thought that, well, there pretty much isn't a reason. So you can kind of do what you want. So I see it as actually being somewhat similar to the student on the train. But Dogen was so unconvinced by this point that he took the dangerous, at the time, trip to China and wandered around quite a while looking for answers. And eventually he found a place, Mount Tiantong Jingde Monastery, where he found the answers he was looking for. And he came back to Japan. And the first thing he did was write the Fukan Zazengi, the Universal Recommendations for Practicing Zazen, which is the kind of seated meditation that we do. And that starts out, okay, memory, please work. The way is basically perfect and all-pervading. How could it be contingent on practice and realization? The ancestral vehicle is free and at ease. What need is there to waste our worthy effort? Indeed, the whole body is far beyond the world's dust. Who could believe in a means to brush it clean? It is never apart from you right here where you are. What is the use of going off here and there to practice? And then if I remember correctly, the next two words are, and yet. So I sometimes like to say these are perhaps this is perhaps the most important and yet in history. And yet, if there is the slightest discrepancy or deviation, I forget what the word is, you are as remote from as heaven from earth. If the least like or dislike arises, the mind is lost in confusion, and so on. And he goes on to elucidate the principles of practicing Zazen, which is the foundation of our practice in Soto Zen Buddhism. And actually, I'd say it doesn't even stop at Dogen. I'd say this fundamental point is older than Buddhism itself. I'd say it's actually, in a way, the fundamental point that the historical Buddha Shakyamuni resolved. It's also represented in the harmony of difference and sameness, which is a piece of liturgy that we chant regularly here. So basically, this is the misunderstanding that every student who hears the harmony of difference and sameness and thinks, yay, sameness. It's all good. So do you see, like, maybe there's a slight, anyway. We're missing something there. So I would say, in a way, we're all the student on the train. I would say that in the world at large, the tendency is to deny that there is a unity or oneness. But in Zen communities, perhaps, there is a tendency in the other direction to cling to the idea that there is only unity and oneness. And neither view is entirely correct on its own. Reality, according to the literature, is that it's both. As Suzuki Roshi succinctly put it, you're perfect as you are, and you could use some improvement. So that sounds a bit cute, perhaps, a nice catchphrase, but I think, in fact, that's the same principle. It's simply describing the reality of the situation in kind of a nice soundbite. So, in San Francisco in the 1960s, there were many young people called hippies. I wasn't alive in the 60s, but I could go on and on. There's second, third-hand stories that one could tell. So Katagiri Roshi was in San Francisco. He originally came to San Francisco and worked with Suzuki Roshi. And then he was invited to come to Minnesota and started Minnesota Zen Meditation Center, and that's where we come from. That's where we come in. But this was the 1960s, so when we talk about hippies, we're talking about actual hippies and the actual hippie scene, which, again, I wasn't actually alive for at that point. I just hear stories, and I'm reluctant to comment. But it was, shall we say, colorful. So what can we say about this next couple paragraphs? There's one thing I'd like to point out because of a mistake that I made in earlier iterations of this talk, which is the student in question is referred to as a hippie-style Zen student. Okay, so the first couple times I gave like some iteration of this talk, I immediately focused on the word hippie. And like, okay, this guy is a hippie, and that's what this is about. And it occurred to me just a couple days ago that actually that is not correct. The most important words there are Zen student. This isn't some just average Joe who on the train, well, okay, it is an average Joe, as we all are. However, it isn't some random person that Katagiri Roshi happened to meet on the train. This is someone who he knows and has either a direct or indirect teaching relationship with. My guess, not knowing any different, is maybe this was a student of Suzuki Roshi's, or it could have been a student of Katagiri's. Either way, Katagiri would have known him. So, that said, that changes the equation a little bit in my mind. So I try hard now to refer to him as a student and not as a hippie. And why does it change the equation? Because, well, we don't know exactly what kind of a student this person was. I mean, it may have just been someone who came like on Sundays, which is great. Or it may have been someone who had a formal declared teaching relationship with one of the teachers. In which case, kind of, I think perhaps, I haven't really thought this through, but I think a teacher might be a little bit more evaluative of how the student responded to a question, a simple question like, Where are you going? So I think somewhere in this part is where we start to get a little bit concerned, perhaps, because people have the idea that we're in this practice to find freedom, and we would like to have some relief from anxiety and fear and anger. I think this comes up a lot. And I think these are all very good reasons to get into Zen practice, particularly that initial entry. But it might sound like at this point that famous local Zen master is saying, nah, not so much. It's all actually drudgery from here on. So you can forget about that peace and equanimity thing. You need to have like a direction. You need to be getting up early in the morning and working really hard. And I would say that's, okay, actually partly true, but not entirely the case. I think what he's saying here is that in a way you get to have your cake and eat it too. You get to care about things and move in a positive direction, and also you get to let go. The two things are actually connected. The reason you get to do both is that life is completely beyond these ideas of caring or not caring, like he says towards the end of that paragraph there. Life is something vast and wonderful, although it's not always friendly towards our ideas. So this next part, where he talks about his experience in the Second World War, is actually very serious. This is true story. You can read Katagiri's biography on the Minnesota Zen Meditation website. And when he was a high school boy, he was drafted, I guess, to help send out kamikaze planes. This was, I think, in the trailing end of the war when things were starting to go badly. And as he says, at any moment, you had to face the reality that you could die. And in fact, a side story here, when he when the war was over, he came back and Japan was a huge mess. And his family was a huge mess. And he didn't know what to do. And was very much wondering, like, what direction his life could take from here on. So eventually he asked if he could become a priest or a monk in the school of Buddhism that his parents belonged to, which he really liked. And they actually didn't need a priest in that tradition, so he got introduced to a Soto Zen priest in some little temple somewhere. And for starters, and for quite a while, he did not like Soto Zen Buddhism at all, is what I understand. But he kept with it and eventually became this foundational guy for us. So I think there's an interesting lesson there that we don't really know what direction our lives are going to take. This is another reason for practicing and being prepared for anything. So I think what he's saying here is that there's some problems with the student's statement about where he's going. Let's talk about what some of the problems are. First of all, and I credit my teacher Sosan for pointing out this one, is that it's probably simply not true. The student is on a train, guessing he probably actually has some idea where he's going and is not technically just relying on his feet. And he probably has some intention about where he's going. But even discounting that, you could say that his response seems a bit facile or easy. And this is a situation that we all encounter where we may think we're letting go, but reality is we're probably not. Okay, I think what Katagiri Roshi is saying with his own example here is that if a bomb went off, this student would probably rediscover some purpose in life pretty quickly, some direction. And the thing is, in life, bombs are going off all the time. Often it's metaphorical bombs. It could be like hard news that we receive. And unfortunately, too much of the time, it's actual literal bombs in many parts of the world. We know this from the news, right? And I think sometimes we have the kind of comfy, safe idea that that could never happen here. Following the news, I don't know about you, I'm starting to lose that comfy, secure feeling a lot more and more a lot of the time. Seems like we're pretty average folks with a pretty average government. So this is why I would say we need to take practice seriously. It's also why it's good to have a teacher, because it's very easy to fool ourselves about how enlightened we are when we're doing things like taking a train somewhere. And finally, being led by your feet, as Katagiri, I think, points out, isn't actually an effective strategy for dealing with life, it turns out. It doesn't work. We tried that pretty hard in the 60s, I think. It's what I'm told. And yet, here we are. And it particularly isn't an effective strategy for being a Zen student. Because it seems being mindful and peaceful actually seems to, paradoxically almost, involve some work. People are sometimes surprised to discover, especially after getting into kind of more serious or regular meditation practice or doing a session, that the aspects of themselves that are coming up may not be particularly pleasant. There may be some things in your own experience that have to be faced, and once you sit down and face whatever is coming up, those things are going to arise at some point. I know they certainly have for me and probably will continue to do so. So I think the problem is, if you're simply following your feet at that point, you're most likely going to be following your feet out the door. So this is where it's useful to have a little bit of guidance and structure. Perhaps not too much. We don't want to become sort of, forgive the expression, Zen Nazis. But we also don't want to be too loose. It's kind of this middle path. So, I love the sentence, this is not a good answer. This just getting up. How much time do we have? So much to get to. What's most important? All right, well, since I only have 10 minutes or so, I think this line, saying I want to do Zazen is not an idea, it is vivid activity, is very interesting. I've been pondering that line a lot, and I don't at the moment have a really great take for you. It's something that you kind of have to feel in a way. But I want to offer a kind of an alternative view of this line. I think what he might mean in one sense here is that it shouldn't be just an idea. Doing Zazen shouldn't be just an idea. It should be vivid activity. If it becomes an idea, we're getting into trouble. I'll give you an example from my own life that's not about meditation. In exercise, there is this phrase, paralysis by analysis. This is where you are reading like lots of new ideas and changing what you're doing in your, you know, like exercise routine and constantly making it better, but it turns out you're actually just making it different and you're not like actually making any progress because you've lost track of what that progress would look like because you're doing something different like all the time. In other words, Katagiri Roshi said in a different talk, if you're practicing archery, you practice with a stationary target. If you're practicing archery with a moving target, someone is perhaps going to get hurt. And that someone might be you. But in this case, we're just talking about what is kind of effective. I give that example because I'm like intimately familiar with that because one of my favorite hobbies is reading books about exercise. So, so I've spent a lot of time thinking about this. Huh, maybe this isn't 100% entirely effective. But at some point, I think doing too much research of that kind can kind of lead into evasiveness, a way of avoiding any actual work. Well, anyway, enough said about that. So I want to talk a little bit about some of the structures that you might find at a Zen meditation center like this one. The most obvious one, and perhaps the most foundational one, is sitting Zazen, doing meditation. And that's what Katagiri is talking about. And I think because he's talking to perhaps a formal student, that there is more of an expectation there that student probably shouldn't just be wandering off wherever his feet lead him. A student should probably be wandering off towards the Zendo at probably 5 in the morning because there's this tradition in Zen practice that Zazen is the first thing we do in the morning. Now, for home-based practitioners, as most of us are to one extent or another, there isn't like perhaps a rule about this. However, I have observed that the morning is a very auspicious time in several ways. In that if you dedicate yourself to doing something first thing in the morning, it's like much more likely that you will actually do that than waiting till later in the day. This is perhaps fairly obvious, but the later you go in the day, the more things are going to come up that will steer you away from that noble intention. So that's one very serious reason why, or one very simple reason why we sit in the morning first thing. Another is that it just helps to establish a tone. It's setting an intention. It doesn't even have to be like for a particularly long time, but it's nice if we set an intention that we're going to try to be mindful and perhaps even recite the Bodhisattva vows to save all beings, realize enlightenment, whether we understand what that is or not. Kind of running out of time, huh? A few more minutes? Well, I want to say, I do. I apologize for blowing the timing on this so badly. All right, letting go. Does anyone have comments?
It's 20 after, so what, you know, if that informs you more specifically.
Let's just give it a minute.
Great talk. What I hear is that you're super scholarly, and I appreciate that. And I think that prior to Zen study, the center of myself is more around that ego self, that that's got to follow the rules in society and make and be busy all the time, and that's who I thought I was. And as I move closer toward enlightenment, I'm moving that center of myself toward the big self, the quiet self. And it's not to eliminate the ego, but it is just to move my center closer to that bigger space and the practices.
One more.
Yeah, so, it's a great talk.
Thank you.
The direction and stuff. And I guess that's what my question relates to. The student is on the train and they don't know where they're going, but clearly they do. You know, there's only one track that they can follow. How do we keep sight of the track? Or, like, I don't know, I'm not sure myself. I don't know if there's like a really concise answer. How do we determine direction? Or, like, do you have any kind of, like, insights into that?
Yes, at least one. The question is, how do we determine or maintain our direction? And part of it is your own North Star, your own internal compass. That's very important, and I don't want to discount that. However, this is where it's very useful to find a teacher and a community. Particularly a teacher is someone who has been on the path before you and knows at least the path that they took to navigate some of these challenges and diversions. And as it's another human being, they can, with some experience, they can offer you a lot of very valuable feedback about where you may be going off from pursuing the central point. Okay, and this is something that applies to everyone. Even like senior teachers have teachers a lot of the time. Does that help?
Yeah, that's very helpful. Thank you.
Okay. I think that's probably all the time that we have. So I would like to say that I just got back from Hokkyoji Zen Monastery, and I brought back a bunch of apples that they picked there. They're on a crate on the table. So this is natural produce from a Zen monastery, and we're trying to get rid of them. So please help yourselves to as many apples as you can stand, or even more. And I'm sorry.
And they're celebrating their 40th year of being around, and sometime in maybe about the fifth year or so, they planted these apple trees. Mm-hmm. So this is the karma of Hokkyoji that has fruited. So I just wanted to put that into your thinking. These aren't just apples.
Thank you.
These are karmic apples.
Thank you. If I had recognized that there was someone from Hokkyoji here, I might have made my announcement slightly differently. Also, there is cake from the Hokkyoji groundbreaking ceremony. And there's plates and forks out there. So they're breaking ground on the new big buildings that they're adding. which is an exciting direction for Hokioji in the future. So please stick around. I'll be around and can chat with you if you'd like to do that, and have some cake.